Welcome to The New Exchange, a podcast series that explores how everyone has a story to tell. My name is Ken Grandpierre, and you're listening to the first summer bonus episode. For the uninitiated, something that I love to do between seasons is release a handful of episodes that are generally a bit more lax than our usual talks. The best thing about these types of episodes is that they're an extension of the podcast, and they allow me to talk to even more people that I deeply respect and admire, like today's guest. I mean, man, listener, my life has been weird. I won't sugarcoat this, I'm a total fanboy when it comes to today's guest. But what's weird is how over the years, they've also become my friends. Metric are a legendary Canadian indie rock band that I would listen to all throughout college. And through a variety of wild circumstances, I've photographed them loads of times over the years. From sold out shows in London to festival stages in Philadelphia, along with practically every New York City show they've done in the last 10 years, I just fucking love this band. And beyond that, I also love them as people, which I think comes across beautifully on today's episode. They've just released their new and eighth album, Formentera, an expansive body of work that explores the human desire for escapism and the fact that we can also never run away from ourselves. Throughout their career, Metric have beautifully challenged themselves and music fans, with this album being no exception. But what is striking is how much the themes of this album coincide with what many of us in society are dealing with at large. Is it even possible to mentally check out when so much is in our face 24/7? Joining me today are Metric, captain, singer, multi-instrumentalist, and guiding light, Emily Haynes, along with Metric first mate, guitarist, and producer, Jimmy Shaw. Yes, we talk about the new album, but more importantly, we talk about life, the ways our ideas of life were challenged throughout these last 2 years, and how we found ourselves recontextualizing the things that mattered most. All bias aside, Metric are easily one of my favorite live bands, and thankfully you'll get the chance to see them soon. The band will be embarking on a 39-date North American tour, starting on August 11th in Victoria, British Columbia. On August 26th, they'll be playing a show that will undoubtedly be iconic at Toronto's Budweiser stage, with support coming from Interpol, Spoon, and my guy, Bartice Strange. US dates begin in September, you'll definitely catch me at the Brooklyn Steel shows happening in October. Be sure to visit ilovemetric.com for all tour dates. Also, of course, I want you to listen to the whole episode, but trust me, you'll definitely want to stick to the very end for a very special story about the indie music world. It's a true gem of a moment. Hand on heart, the more this series evolves, the more personal the talks become, and this one is a prime example of just that. I hope you love this one as much as I do. This is The New Exchange with Metric. Enjoy. I genuinely love when I get to start talks like this. Emily and Jimmy, how have you been?
We've been good. It's been a while since we've talked to you. It's been a while since
a lot of things
happened.
Yeah, I mean, God, just to put it mildly, I can't even remember the last time. I think it might have been that Hammerstein show and that tour. But it's
yeah,
so
that
nice.
You know what? That's a good way to narrow it down. Yeah. That show on that tour.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I live in Greenpoint now, and it's going to be mentioned in the intro, people just heard, but you guys are going to be touring in the autumn, and I just love knowing I'll be able to walk to your show the next time you guys come over. It's going to be amazing.
Amazing.
Brooklyn Steel.
And we'll be able to walk to your place. Which
Thank
is
you.
Even,
That's
which,
great. Appreciate
exactly.
it.
Yeah, you can hang out with my dog. I'm sure she'll love to hear meet you. She's heard the records out loud numerous times. So. the place I wanted to start with this is that when I read about the story behind the album title, it really struck me in a way that I wasn't expecting, because for those who don't know, the title is a reference to a small island off the coast of Spain, which for you only existed as a dream destination of sorts in a travel book in a studio, I think I read, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of funny. Reading that reminded me of when I was 18. I was in art school, and one of my professors had one of those, like, big atlas books, and it had photos of the world. And I distinctly to this day remember seeing photos of Morocco for the first time, and my 18-year-old brain not being able to comprehend that this was a real place that existed on Earth. I remember feeling kind of mystified. Can you talk to me a bit about how seeing this place for you, this like island in Spain, how it inspired you on a creative level?
Yeah, I mean, kind of to what you said, I think there's precedent in certainly people's lives and also in art of this concept of a physical place is in fact imaginary, you know, for practical purposes, it's imaginary. So, you know, a couple of years into a lockdown in the middle of winter in a rural hamlet in Canada, you know, some people going a little bit squirrely, people who are used to traveling for work and, you know, sensing that the world is open to us, whether we can go or not. That picture that we turned to in that book came to symbolize everything we felt like we'd lost or was inaccessible to us, possibly forever, and that we had to come to terms with that and create our own version of it for ourselves. Because even, you know, without a global pandemic and literally borders closed, for a lot of people, jumping on a yacht and going to a pristine island in the Mediterranean is not like that possible. So we were kind of playing around with that, the reality, and how do you create that place for yourself if the physical is unavailable to you for whatever.
And you know, I am going to ask about specific songs off the album as a whole, but it was really interesting in reading about the story of the album and considering what you just said there, Emily. It's like, after having been a fan of your band for so many years, I think this is arguably the most timely album Metric have ever made. Is that something you feel aware of as you've been like reflecting on it more?
I have no idea what's going on. I mean, how do you feel?
I'm not sure. It's really hard, at least for us, maybe, to make art and know whether it's timely or not. Like, it's like we always feel like it's timely for us. It's just maybe we're like more or less connected to what's actually going on in the rest of the world at different time. It seems like at this point in time, it would make a lot of sense that we were very much connected to the rest of the world because everyone was kind of going through the same thing, you know? And This wasn't a time when, you know, the first world was going through this, the third world was going through this. I don't know what the second world's doing at all. And this is like the whole planet was really going through something. And I think at this given moment, everyone can kind of relate to a feeling of like claustrophobia, loss of control, you know, all sorts of sort of running themes throughout this record.
Yeah, that's definitely what I was speaking to. Thank you for putting it so eloquently, Jimmy. I think it's that aspect of I truly want to find a word that feels more pronounced and expansive than the word escapism. But I think what's interesting with the music you've created in this particular vein and how I feel like it kind of ties into just society at large is that you can desire escapism and almost genuinely feel like you need it from an eternal point of view, but it doesn't take away from feeling existential about life and towards a life that you're living. And I feel like that's mm-hmm. what you've contrasted really well in some of these songs.
Well, it's cool that you are making that distinction because I have the same struggle too when I use the word escape, because I think the association we make with that is like that you're bailing on paying attention or you're tuning out or you're disconnecting. And there's like a really key lyrical thing in Doomscroller in the piano section where, you know, making the distinction like not something to conceal it, more like a magnification mirror. So the idea of like you're taking something, for all I know, it might be mushrooms. you know, your purpose for taking something to deal with how you're feeling is not to disappear into like suppression of the reality of the things that are really messed up right now, or the reality of your own, you know, state of disrepair or struggle, you know, internally. That it's the idea is that it's the opposite. And so in the same way, I feel like to the extent that we created an escape, it's like going deeper in, you know, as opposed to being checking out. But I haven't been able to find a word for that either. Like, because I have the same, I think we all have the same associations, like escape is like, peace out. Like, what are you talking about? I have no idea. I don't care. But it's not apathetic. It's not any of those things. So let me know if you find the word.
I absolutely will. As you were saying that, it made me think about something that, like, I correlate this with like painters, but I know musicians do it too, but it's like a utility that I'm going to bring up that I think functions in everyday life as well, where I've seen it before of artists in the studio where they're just like working on a song and then they feel like they have to like go outside for a walk or just like not to look at like, you know, the guitar or the keyboard. And then after that walk, they come back and have a totally different, fresh perspective. I think that could be reflective of life as well, where you have like these things going on in your life or outside of your own immediate life, and you need a second to breathe and then to just recontextualize these things and make more sense of them.
For sure. I mean, I felt like that's a huge part of what was happening for us. Not like in the momentary where, you know, you may be working on something and need a 20-minute break, but the pandemic, at least in the beginning for us, and for a lot of people, was like that. It was that walk, you know. It was like you've been working on something for 20 years and we all got like a couple months to just go for a walk and figure out what the hell was going on, you know, and be able to kind of come back at it with like a slightly different approach, right? Whether that was like a positive thing, a negative thing for people. I mean, it was a lot of things for a lot of different people, but for us, like one of the things that happened is we started making music in the countryside as opposed to like deep urban realities. And that sort of like objective space and time to reflect and to realize what you're doing and have moments, you know, of like immersion and, you know, have moments away from the music were like really different for us. And it really affected the music in a different way. Like it showed to me in the music at the end of it, because there's just more reflection going on and there's more sort of our own objectivity, like in our own process, you know, and that's something we never really did before.
And I'm glad how you put that, because I feel like this ties so nicely into the first song I want to ask you about, because, you know, while listening to this album, so many things leapt up at me. And I was, you know, it's actually kind of interesting. I think in the context of my life, I think the Metric newsletter is probably the longest newsletter I've been a part of in my life. I think I signed up back in like 2009 or something.
And, amazing.
I bring that up because I remember how in one of the newsletters you described Doom Scroller, and I feel like the way it was described is how you could describe the album as a whole. And it was described as a sonic voyage that transports you into a high-speed chase through the wild terrain of modern life. The word that leaps to me there is voyage, which I feel has been a fixture of Metric's music for years. And I feel like it's very succinct there. So do you feel like that word informed the actual recording of the song or this album at all?
It's kind of a weird one, you know. It's like halfway through the making of the song Doom Scroller, especially, we started becoming aware of the fact that we were doing something epic and longer than usual, maybe a longer voyage than usual. But it definitely wasn't the thing we like set out to do. It just kind of unfolded that way. And then as we started becoming aware of what it was doing naturally and where it was wanting to go, we definitely leaned into it and went all the way with it. When it came down to like where it was going to sit on the album, we didn't really feel like there was a choice other than to put it first, because of kind of what you said about it. It's kind of encapsulating the feeling of the rest of the record anyway. And one of the things that we've always felt like was really important with an opening track was for it to do that. It's like you almost get like a mini version of the whole record, and then you get the expanded version of the whole record, you know. And Doom Scroller less mini maybe, but still sort of
version.
A maxi version of a mini max version.
You guys really, like, as you said that, you guys really have done that like to a degree your whole career. Like, I think about songs like Help I'm Alive and Artificial Nocturne, and they really do that.
It's actually been empty. It's been a conscious thing that we've actually like decided on doing like since the very beginning.
You know what? I think the only record that it didn't happen on is Pagans, and maybe that explains a lot of things. But Lie was
It's pretty telling.
It's
about
pretty
the rest
telling
of the
about the whole thing. That's true.
Yeah, the whole record's just a lie.
Yeah, it was weird, like, to Jimmy's point about the Doom Scroller process, like, it's so true, like, we weren't like, and now, like, our big conceptual thing. It was like one of the most unusual creative processes, like, which is saying a lot for 20 years of making music together, like, where it was just, it was like the in most cases, the song feels done. Like there's the song and you're like, I've gone where I need to go. And now the song is going to end. And with that one, it was like the emotion, it wasn't resolving until we got to where we got. And the first section was a piece of music that Jimmy and Liam, who was a big part of this album, they had worked on. It was a piece that they kind of presented to me to write on. I had like the weirdest experience with that, where I think we'd listened to a bunch of stuff and then those guys left. And in the morning I was listening to it and it was like, I guess this happens a fair amount of time, but in this case, it just was pretty stunning for me. I was like, I hear this whole thing and I have every word. And I texted them, they were on their way over. I was like, can you get here? Can you just set up the mic and let me just record this?
Wow.
And that's the vocal that's on the record. Like I heard it like bird song or something. It was super like entwined with the natural environment. And like, I don't know what the hell that experience was. But so we had that section with like the crazy dance, like troll hellscape. And then I felt that that needed to end with piano, which I had envisioned being sort of a coda, like just, but then I ended up writing that whole piece, which was a little bit more truncated. And then you were like, oh, you heard a way to expand that and sort of develop those. You heard more in it than I did. And then, so that became that. And then you heard the guitar at this thing at the end that we got to get to this like euphoric moment with like the scary memory of the little trolls, like in the background of the synth still haunting. And it was wild. And then when we got there, we weren't like, and now it needs to be something else. It felt like, okay, it happens to be how long it happens to be, but that was the ride. That was the voyage.
Wow. I love all of that. And first, the aspect of like the lyrical journey of that and how it was sung, I feel like that very much comes across. So it's interesting here that was the way it was actually crafted. And I think the big thing about this, the biggest achievement of this song is that it doesn't feel dense, at least. Like, it doesn't at all to me. And funnily enough, right before I was chatting with you guys, I was chatting with a friend of mine from Ireland. I've known him since I was like 15 years old. He's the reason I got into Metric. Like, he gave me Old World Underground when I was in college, like when I was like 19. And we were catching up and I told him about like how I would be talking to you guys, how you have this new album and the song. And when I mentioned that you had like a close to 10-minute song, he reacted like, he said, oh man, that's so cool. I love when a band's around for a long time and they realize they can do whatever the fuck they want.
Exactly.
That's what that song is. Like, and I think that's the magic, where there's so many acts that would do that and let it run away with them, but you didn't do that.
I mean, we definitely feel like we can do whatever the fuck we want.
And the album is indicative of that, isn't it? Like, I feel all the records have been, but I feel like this is the one where it's like more of a, if in Art of Doubt you like planted a flag on the ground, I feel like this new album's where there's like the cracks underneath it, maybe.
Sure, I love that. It's beautiful. It feels like that. It feels like we just, I mean, in the process of making the record, it was like we didn't know if any of this was going to continue. So it's like, why still worry then? You know.
Well, that's the whole this Formentera thing, which is now I find myself probably to the equal amount of amusement and irritation of my loved ones. Where I just am like, hey, Formentera, man. Like, I don't know. Like, what are you going to do? It really, you know, as you feel with the flow of the album, the beginning, it's just how much stress can one, like, you know, a nervous system tolerate? Speaking from experience, like, you know, the adrenaline and all those, the fight or flight chemicals and hormones that run through our bodies under this, like, insane duress of, like, you know, so much information about really disturbing, terrible things, and you're just sitting in your stupid house and you can't do anything about it. Like, it's one thing if you have access to information that you can act on, but so much of it now, it's just like an onslaught. If you're someone who cares, like if you feel a responsibility to stay informed and stay engaged, it's a recipe for like a complete fucking meltdown. So what you feel in that record, and I hope we did it right, is like that first part until you get to Formentera, it's like you're cracking up, right? But then the strings come in and it's just like, okay, this is unsustainable, you know, you gotta get there somehow in your mind. And I think to Jimmy's point, like that was a lot of our worst fears happened. Like as a touring musician who relies on playing music, you've built a career for 20 years. And we didn't even see Josh and Jules for an entire year because they couldn't get across the border. Like,
wow.
We were already in our worst case scenario. And I think you're maybe that's part of what you're feeling of the like, we can do whatever the fuck we want. And really the thing of Formentera, of the like, why not just let go? The stakes are not my own. I mean, what? We're here. We've got each other. We're going to do something. You know, maybe it's like bongo jams for the rest of our lives. I have no idea. But what became clear was it's not going to be possible to cling like so hard to things outside of our power and our control, or even the world we knew it before this all happened, you know. So that's all kind of wrapped up in there.
Yeah, and I'd really love to distill the context in what you're saying as well, where you brought up not being able to see Josh and Jules for all years. These are two people you spent over 20 years with building this thing that Metric is. And you know, obviously the element of society and what's going on a multitude of levels worldwide is so important, but those interpersonal relationships, that aspect of like dedicating your time and your energy towards building something, having the rug pulled out, it's like there's no lesson in life prior to this experience that would have prepared anyone for that. And so that must have just been so trippy to go through.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing was trippy. And I mean, that was definitely a huge part of it. But you know, Canada was pretty intense in 2020 in terms of its rules and lockdowns.
And 2021, the Hunger Games to try to get vaccines. We couldn't get vaccines. We were like signing up to like all these crazy lists, like Twitter feeds to try to find vaccines. It was like the weirdest.
Yeah, it was a weird time. So that was definitely a huge part of it, but it was one of a million things that was just super weird.
No, it was the wildest thing. I want to ask about another song off the album. Funnily enough, the first song you released, All Comes Crashing. I feel like lyrically this track explores, well, I write about it, so I think I'm right, how love and relationships go beyond the conventional nuclear family that we grew up seeing. And this kind of goes back to how I said that this album feels very timely, because alternative ways of just viewing relationships, I feel, are nothing new, but the prominence, the very focal of it, I feel now is, you know, more apparent than ever, especially in a city like New York, a city like Toronto. What role did this song play within the recording process of the album? Like, was it like a puzzle piece in any way?
It was, in that it was
funny that you say it was a total puzzle piece. It was the final puzzle piece. And it was the thing that we knew we were missing. And we sat down, Emily had written a bunch of songs. Emily played me and Gus three songs just right off of your phone. Just was like, you know, phone recordings when you're sitting at the piano. And I think you probably played that one third, which would be classic, you. And Gus and I were just like, that's the tune in exactly that form. We just have to arrange it and do it. It was the last thing we did. Had Josh and Jules come up one more time, did that tune. And it does, it kind of ties the album together, because there's a lot of like, to me anyway, there's a lot of like complex emotional content, you know, meaning complex, just meaning even more than one idea at a time, you know. And this one, it's like, it is one idea. It's like, who's there when the shit hits the fan, and who's it going to be for you? And that's a very primal thing that I think, again, we all kind of like felt for, you know, really for the first time in sort of like a global sense. You know, everyone's had, you know, shit hit the fan, obviously some people much more than others, but this thing was like it was a global, like, who's going to be standing next to you? And it really did kind of like tie the whole thing together.
Which is funny on the standing tip, because my whole purpose in the writing of it was exactly what you're tuned into, like this is not a conventional love song. And I think the original lyric was standing, and it was. And then we were discussing it and you were like, I think it's lying. And I really fought that we discussed it because I was like, oh man, but that implies like lying in bed. But the way that I reconciled it, because my visual was always like this, like there's the nuclear war and you're like, all right, like, you know, it's not like, oh, perfect couple, like being perfect. Like that wasn't what I pictured at all. So I was like, I pictured like almost like you're at a concert. Like I think I said, like you're at a Metric concert and it's the end of the world. You look and you go like, yes, I'm here with my best friend. Like that is my emotion behind it. So I really grappled with standing versus lying. But the way I came to terms with it was that, well, if it's like you're dead, then you're going to be lying next to them. So you were standing when it happened, but then you're lying beside them. So I was like, okay. But I really, and I'm so pleased that that part of like the description of the song seems to have circulated. And I think you feel it in the song as well, that it isn't like a standard sort of siloed kind of love, you know, it's different than that.
I love that I've known you too and the band for so many years, long enough that I could say it. That was one of the most Emily Haynes thing that you probably could have said ever. That was very on brand for you.
Yeah. Not going anywhere.
It did hit me, by the way, that the last time I saw you was actually not Hammerstein. It was like 2019 when you played King's Theater during Art of Doubt.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That was an amazing show. And I realized within that, I haven't had the chance to talk too much about it because that album was fantastic as well. I loved everything around it, especially how you performed. It was like, I remember watching that show and feeling, oh, this is a band that's been together for a long time and they know exactly what to do. And like, I wonder, do you feel like the recording and the touring for Art of Doubt influenced how you approached Formentera? Or does it feel like because of the pandemic, there was so much distance that that didn't inform anything?
I mean, I think if anything, what it did is like, because we rerouted ourselves in guitar-based rock music for Art of Doubt, it allowed us to once again feel free of needing to establish that, yes, there are guitars. Don't worry. Because after Pagans, it was like Fantasies went a certain way after our first two sort of much more basic, you know, four-piece rock band records. Synthetica went a step further. Pagans went a giant step further. And, you know, a lot of the, you know, the comments that we were seeing and the fan perspective was like, where's what happened to the rock band? You know, when the guitar player is the guy producing the record and leaving the guitar out, there's a change of direction happening. And so Art of Doubt allowed us to be like, no, don't worry, we're a rock band. So when we were making this stuff, we felt like probably the biggest sense of freedom, because we'd established that now we can do that, we can come back, we can go forward, we can do rock, we can do electronic, we can do whatever the fuck we want.
It's balance, I think, on this record, on Formentera. Like, there's so much. I hope it comes across that way to you. Like, I love the guitars on this record.
Me too. I think it's the most, to me, it's the most balanced record we've made probably since Fantasies. But I think the synth playing in particular has gone so much further than it was in 2010. Like, it's the electronics are so much further developed that it really feels nicely balanced though. Like I love it.
Yeah, and you know, I remember talking to you, Jimmy, like a little bit before Art of Doubt about like how you took a backseat from production on that one because you wanted to kind of fall in love with guitar again and just be in the band. Who produced Formentera, and like who did that kind of help like that experience?
I was like the primary producer for it, but then I worked with these two other guys that like are sort of like long time musical like family member is this guy Liam O'Neill. He's used to play in the Stills. There was a time in 2010 when we were making Synthetica, 2011 maybe, when Emily asked Liam if he wanted to stay in Toronto for 3 days to help us work on some recordings, and he stayed for 5 years and became like family. He now plays keyboards in the Kings of Leon as well as doing stuff with us. And when Kings of Leon were like, they were like about to put out a record, I think it was actually March 20th, 2020. And that got pulled, obviously. And they kind of put everything on hiatus. He lives in Nashville. So we called him and we were like, well, why don't you just try and get you up here? He's Canadian, so he could get in. And we ended up working with you again. He was going to come up and stay with me and my wife down the road from our studio for like 8 weeks, and he stayed for a year and a half. It seems to be a
pattern. Yeah, kind of like the pandemic, where it's like, get 2 weeks of groceries.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. And so me and him ended up kind of doing all of this stuff and ended up producing everything together. And until the point where we wanted Josh and Jules to get up here and do these band recordings, and then we kind of got this other guy named Jeff Van Gogh to do it. And it was the first time I really had an experience where they were like genuinely kind of three producers in the room. I think that they were deferring to me to make like final decisions and stuff, but the process and the workload was like really spread evenly throughout the three of us. We had a saying going for the entire time that was like, oh man, I'll never work on a project with anything less than three producers ever again. Like, it's because it was so evenly spread. No one was like, the band was partying and the producer was like, you know, stuck at Pro Tools for 14 hours at a time. Like, it was just so even, and everyone kind of was able to sort of access all of their abilities and talents. And so
for me, it was great because it completely, you know, I'm not a big fan of conventional paradigms when it comes to power structures. Yeah. So I've always struggled. Shocker. Yeah. I've always struggled with the like, oh, look, it's like band dad is now you're producing. Like, obviously you get great results with great people and it does work. You need leadership, but I was just like stunned because I was having the best time because all three of them can do all these things. And there was none of the stupid ego proprietary stuff happening. I couldn't believe it. And on top of that, for the first time in my life, I recorded vocals in actually other than Grow Up and Blow Away when we had no choice because it's like you have one room, but I recorded vocals in the control room. So the whole like fishbowl thing that I really have struggled with but thought was just something I had to do was
half,
like
half the vocals were done in your house.
That's true.
Before we even like moved studios, and we just had like a
but even then at my house it was like right there in the studio. So I'm like, I just felt like all the processes were like flowing together. The lyrical ideas were like conversational, which was has always been the case. Like, you know, I was talking to the band about like, this is what this is about or how do you feel about this, you know, but like it was creatively like, honestly, such a great process. I feel the same. I'm never going back to less than three producers.
Do you know what's so crazy? I only have a couple more questions for you guys, by the way, but I just wanted to point out, I know that band editors really well in the UK, and they're at a point now where they very much operate in that way with multiple producers that they're really good friends with. But I remember talking to them about it maybe 2-3 years ago, and they were saying, and it kind of echoes what you're saying, it's like, once they figured out they could work in that way, it was almost like having different lobes of their brain activated or something.
Totally.
It's so much more freeing, and it's like, when I need to be producer and when I need to put that hat on and go in, the other two guys were like, by all means, go in. You know, when I was like, I need to not think about that. I need to pick up the guitar. I need to go to an instrument. I need to go for a 2-hour walk. I need to go to the city for a minute. You know, it's like, it didn't feel like the whole thing was just going to like collapse if I left the room, you know? And it was just so much more freeing and easy.
Yeah. A big question that I have for you is also a very basic one, but what's a song you're most looking forward to people hearing and why?
I mean, for me, it's Formentera.
We
had these amazing couple shows. We've like launched everything for Mexico City, which was the dream. And we had all our expectations were very low because we all had to change up what we think will happen as opposed to what will happen, what we think will happen. So in Mexico City, we got to play Dream Scroller and All Comes Crashing for the first time, and that was just like, that felt so good. But I think Formentera, to just like settle in that and play that song is going to be, you know, because I really believe in this like self-fulfilling thing, like the functionality and usefulness of songs, like Help I'm Alive, you know, was single-handedly the thing I wrote that allowed me to overcome my like crippling stage fright, because I'm like, poison arrows were being shot at my face, which is not entirely wrong, but just saying, like, standing up and saying, I tremble, they're going to eat me alive if I stumble, was then it was like what I was saying was changing the reality of that thing. So I'm so curious what will happen with Formentera if like singing it and playing it will sort of manifest this sense of like peace.
And like, you know, I should point out, I was thinking about this earlier today. I was trying to pinpoint the first time. I think I've been to something like 20 metric shows, which is a crazy thing to say out loud, but I think the first one for me was Terminal 5, 2009.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, fantasies.
Yeah, and like, I bring that up because I think something that's been incredible over the arc of all those shows and those different album cycles has been seeing how your songs do change the vibe of a room. And I even think about like that very first show I saw you when I was 19 years old. And what's crazy is that I remember I had heard Twilight Galaxy and I wasn't like keen on it, like the recorded version. But then you open the set with that. And I remember that completely changed my feeling on the song. And now it's like still one of my favorite Metric songs. And like, it just goes to the power of what you could do as a band. It kind of ties back to the Kinks Theater show I saw you at back in 2019, where I think a big thing about that show that sticks out to me was that felt like, for all the production that you've had, all the stage props over the years, I feel like that was the show where you guys were like, no, we're like a big rock band that's had a long career. Let's have a set list that reflects that. And do you feel like that's kind of like what we'll see with this upcoming tour as well? Like that idea of the set list of like showcasing all these different shades of the band?
I think so. I mean,
that's what we did in Mexico and it felt really good.
Yeah.
And it's weird with time how these things that seemed like they had huge divides between them now don't sound so divided. Like a song like Gimme Sympathy, we played that before as like our acoustic moment, you know, or something, but we, for a long time, we didn't play like the album version. And now the album version just sits like completely fine next to like something from Art of Doubt. I don't understand why, but it does. Mm. So I feel like that's what I got from that Mexico show, the headline show in particular, like exactly what you're saying, that I think it's just going to be like a best of.
I mean, I do feel like a big rock band who's had a really long career, so I can't see how it wouldn't feel like that. If we feel like that, you will probably end up feeling like that.
Before we run, I just wanted to make note about the upcoming Bud stage show that you guys have coming up, and the lineup for that is crazy. I love everyone that's involved. I mean, the guys in Spoon, like Brit and Jim are such amazing people. I love Daniel and Interpol. And a really good friend of mine, Bartice, is opening. And I just wanted to point out, the last time I talked to him, that we spent 30 minutes talking about Metric. He's like a proper OG Metric fan. So
no way.
Opening that is awesome. It's awesome, yeah.
That, okay, so you have to tell him. So I, when this, it was in February, I think this was first getting discussed. I was in Miami. And I remember being sent his music. And I hadn't heard it. And I was like in the back of the cab and I was like, what is happening? I love this so much. I remember I texted you. I was like, listen to this. Like, we got to make this happen. So the fact that we're getting to play together. And then hilariously, he wrote that song, We Should Go to Toronto More Often.
Yeah. Heavy Hearts. That's right before the chorus. Yeah.
Amazing.
I was like, okay, first of all, that's brilliant. Because it's obviously just, you know, it's obviously just hyping up our show together. So I really appreciate that. But I'm so excited. And that's just, I'm thrilled to hear that he knows our music. And because for us to play with Interpol is such a trip back to the early days in New York, where, you know, like Sam was working at Beacon's Closet when it was still small.
Did he really?
Yeah, because his wife owned that. And Jules was going out with Sam's wife's best friend, and we had our, you know, album shelved, so we were circulating our music on these CDRs that we burned, all the songs from Grow Up and Blow Away, and this is, you know, before we'd done anything. This was in like 2001 or whatever, and we got those CDRs into the little music section at Beacon's Closet. Like, I remember going in and being like, hey, and actually kind of knowing that Sam played the drums just because Jules had said, but being like, hey, like, and Emily, would you guys carry this, please? He's like, sure, like, put it, slot your CDR in there. And that's how Jules heard Metric. And then when we played, we were in England being rejected for about a year. And then we came back to New York with our tails between our legs, played a like ridiculous two-piece show at Fez under the Time Cafe, which is now Lafayette, but restaurant. We played a show where Jimmy was like, never again, because he was playing drums. And Jules was one of the only people there. And then we went afterwards to see Unitard at Black Betty, because they were our roommates. It was Nick and Karen from Yaya's doing their little side project thing. So we were just like, they were there commiserating, and Jules came up to us and said, you know, actually, I think he came up to you and said, hey, I've got to tell you, I've heard those songs. I heard that CDR, like the Art of Beacon's Closet. Like,
oh my God.
Do you want to, I love you guys. And Jimmy was like, great. He's so pissed off and drunk and like, great. You want to, you love the band? Why don't you join the band? Jules was like, sure.
Yeah. He said, you guys are my favorite band. I was like, oh yeah, if we're so great, why don't you just join it? And he was like, okay. And I was like, oh, what do you play? He said, I play drums. I was like, great. We got a drummer.
And then later, because it was such a small community at that time in Williamsburg, like, I can't remember. I feel like it was like, I'm forgetting his name, but who worked it. He was like affiliated with Diner and those guys. Mm-hmm. But he was like Rich or something.
Yeah, Rich.
Rich was like, Jimmy, like, you don't, do you have any idea who that guy is? We were like, no, he's just like.
Yeah, I go to work the next day at the diner where I was waiting tables. And this guy, Rich, who was coming every day, he comes in and he's like, dude, you got the best drummer in New York last night. And I was like, so I don't know what you're talking about. And he was like, this guy Jules introduced himself to you at the bar. He told me about it. He's like, stoked that he's in your band. And I was like, oh yeah, that guy. And he was like, I'm telling you, he's like an amazing drummer. You got to follow it up. But just beware, he won't answer his phone ever, and he won't ever call you back. But stay on it. Stay on it.
Which is true to this day.
It's true. I didn't hear back for 2 weeks. And then finally, God, when they did hear back, he was like, yeah, totally, I'm in the band. What's going on?
And then he introduced us to Josh, because the two of them had moved from Texas to New York to basically find us. You know, we were the double duos that found each other. So all that linked back to
Sam working the record counter at Beacon's Closet, yeah, allowing us to sell the CD there.
Thank you so much for sharing that. That is so beautiful.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, I love those two so much. I mean, that's such a great way to end. And before we do, I just want to say that, you know, genuinely from the bottom of my heart, I'm really happy that you guys are still here. I know this is your career and your lives, but it really can't be overstated how special it is that you've not only made so many albums, but you've continuously challenged yourselves and your audience. I like to point out to people all the time that when there's a band or a singer-songwriter or a DJ or anyone who's like making challenging music, it's really important to point it out, because no one in their lives reinforces that outside of the spectrum of the group. And there's no one that will go, there's no one who's friends with a musician who says, hey, challenge yourself. I have never seen it happen. So
yeah,
I feel there's a trust that the fans have towards your band that is truly unique. And it's something that I, as a fan, feel is very special. So yeah, I just wanted
to. That's amazing. That's really special to hear.
Thank you.
What
a cool conversation. Tell your friend in Dublin that we're going to be coming there.
Oh, Belfast, actually.
He's Belfast. Damn.
He'll take the bus. He'll take the bus. He's done. Okay, great. He went to go see like MCR and Haim. He'll go see you guys.
Okay, good. All
right. Guys, thank you so much. This was beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for checking this out. Be sure to subscribe to The New Exchange via Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you stream podcasts. Until next time, thank you for listening.